Love, Janessa is the true crime podcast from the BBC World Service and CBC Podcasts, investigating the murky world of online romance scams.
She was trying to get me to send her money.
Catch up with the whole series now. Search for Love, Janessa wherever you found this podcast.
You win their hearts, you win their wallets.
Hey, you're listening to On the Podium on the BBC World Service, the show that registers a 9.7 on the inspiration scale, week in and week out, as Paralympians and Olympians parade their talent and secrets to success. With me, as always, is the BBC's athletics commentator, Ed Harry, and Paralympian, Scout Bassett. When we're going to get to talk to one of the real athletes on this show. And obviously by that, I mean the mascots who really bring the competition and heart to any sport. Do you guys have any favorite mascots?
Yes, because I think it's really a difficult job to do. And like, I don't know, in a team sport, when you go somewhere a couple of times a month to your home court or your home ground, I think you might semi-ignore the mascot because, oh yeah, I'm going to my seat. There they are doing their thing. But when I go to big track and field meets like World Championships or an Olympics, some of these people have never, ever been to something like that before. So what the mascot's doing is actually really important for that hour or so before it starts, trying to get an atmosphere going. And
they have mascots at the at track and field stuff?
Yeah.
Oh.
At the big champs, always. And they've always got my favorite, the Berlin World Championships. That's where Usain Bolt set the world records that are still the world records in the sprints. Berlino, the bear. And he was great because he totally got involved.
Yeah, they didn't really stretch for the name, though.
Not really. They were in Berlin. He's a bear. The thing I remember most is he almost dropped an athlete. She just won a gold medal in the hurdles. She was called Bridget Foster Hilton. She was like, "Hey!" And so he went along, like, "Hey!" And he kind of jump on her. So he sort of was giving her a piggyback. And he sort of half did drop her. And luckily, she'd won her gold medal by then. But he was in amongst it. He wanted to be part of it. And I say he, I don't know, because I don't know who was inside the suit, but they, to use the correct mascot pronoun, they were an awesome bear. And it was really, really cool.
Wow.
I mean, most of my mascot knowledge comes from baseball. I mean, the first one that comes to mind is obviously the Philly Fanatic. Green, fuzzy, very voluptuous shaped mascot.
Sort
with
of a pear-shaped fella, right?
Very pear-shaped with the big giant nose. But you know what's interesting is some of these mascots, at least in baseball, like have their own social media accounts.
I mean, they've got fans. It makes sense.
Instagram and Twitter, and they like clap back at fans. It's hysterical. And I'm always like, are the teams running these accounts? Or like, who's running, like who's behind running the mascot social media account?
It's really hard though, isn't it? Because when your hands are so big and furry in some cases, it's quite hard to hit the keys.
Oh, Ed, usually there's a person inside that suit.
Take my headphones off and stop listening because you're going to ruin the magic of the mascots.
Yeah, I feel like Gritty, the Philadelphia NHL team.
Flyers, yeah.
Yeah. Gritty has to have probably the best social media presence.
Yeah, it's a good one. I wonder if any of these people are like actually notable, right? Like what if we found out one day like it was like somebody like, I don't know, a bench player, or we found out it was like the front office or something. I don't know, you know?
I thought you meant sort of like, you know, apart from being in the Beatles, Sir Paul McCartney has spent the last 40 years being a mascot at his local club,
yes,
or whatever or something.
He would get mobbed at the grocery store as Paul McCartney, but not as Bebo the Fruit Loop.
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right, let's get on the podium. Who's with us this week, Ed?
Our guest today was their country's first Paralympic gold medalist in any sport. Because of her victory in the pool in Beijing in 2008, Singapore's national anthem was heard in a victory ceremony at the Paralympic Games for the first time. Our guest has gone on to win four more golds at the Games, two in Rio, two in Tokyo, and in between, she served as a member of Singapore's parliament. Yip Pin Xiu, welcome to On the Podium.
Thank you so much for having me today.
We're so glad to have you. We're going to be taking a look at some photos from your life to guide our conversation. So let's check out that first photo.
Pinch, you were looking at a picture of you with your gold medal at the 2008 Paralympic Games in Beijing. I guess before we talk about the feeling of that medal being around your neck, how old were you? When did the Olympic dream become a reality? When did you know you were even going to be going to these games?
This photo was of me when I was 16. I started training competitively at around 11. When I first started training, the Paralympics wasn't really a dream. I just really loved competing. I loved swimming. And over time, we eventually worked to the point where I could qualify for the Paralympics. And that was the time where I put in a lot of effort into it. We were training 13 times a week, purely swim sessions, and then 4 or 5 more times in the gym every other day. So there was a lot of training when I was still in secondary school. Really a lot of sacrifice throughout the years there. But I think it's really amounted to something. And in Beijing, it was just spectacular because it was the very first time the national anthem was played in an Olympic arena. Words cannot describe how I felt, you know. I can still very vividly remember my race. Like, it's so etched in my memory. Every single stroke I took during the race, every shot frame by frame still lives in my head rent-free. And it was amazing.
Well, I think we should probably tell people first, can you tell us about what your disability is? And then we can talk a little bit more about how you adapt to the backstroke, given what you have.
So I have this condition called Charcot-Marie Tooth. It used to be under the muscular dystrophy umbrella, but now it's more of a neurological condition. This condition has affected me ever since I was 3 years old. It's a condition that causes my muscles to deteriorate over time. And I used to be able to walk when I was younger, but at 12, I had to be on a wheelchair. And since then, I've learned how to pretty much adapt and cope with it.
So given that you do the backstroke, can you tell us how this condition affects or what limbs or parts of your body that is impaired because of the disability?
So this condition affects my forelimbs and my trunk as well. Backstroke's my favorite event because I think for the rest of the strokes, it requires a lot more trunk movement, a lot more rotation to be efficient in the stroke. When I was, okay, so in swimming, there are different kinds of classifications. When it comes to physical disability conditions, it's S1 to S10. The higher the number, the more functional you are. So I started off as a 5, and then a 4, 3, and then now a 2. So over the years, the condition has really deteriorated. But I think being consistent in training and consistent in my efforts has really made it a bit easier over time. The deterioration hasn't been extremely drastic. Okay, that's how I like to think about it. That's my mindset when it comes to it, because I don't want to feel like it's gotten so bad that I cannot do anything. So I think in a sense, I put a really positive spin into it so that I can still function and do my best as a person.
Taking it away from competitive swimming and all the amazing things you've done at the Paralympics, how much more freedom, full stop, do you feel when you are in the pool versus being out on dry land and using your wheelchair?
I feel a huge sense of freedom in the water. And that was the very first thing that drew me to swimming in the first place. On land, when I was younger and I could walk, I needed help. But in the water, I could do anything that anybody else could do. And I absolutely loved it. There were no barriers. I could do somersaults, headstands. That was what sparked my love for water in the first place.
You said that when you got your medal, it was the first time that your national anthem was played in any Olympic arena, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So what was it like returning home after that?
Homecoming was really sweet. I think for a 16-year-old who didn't know much about anything, at that point in time, my life was just swimming, studying, repeat the same thing every single day. But coming home to that, like, to have the whole nation kind of celebrate it, for para sports to gain awareness, reach for more people to know about it. It was significant for me. And I think if I were to pick a year where the movement grew in Singapore, that would be it.
Yeah, I would imagine it would have to.
Did people want to know not just more about you, but more about people with disabilities, full stop? I mean, when you were growing up, was there anybody in public life, in sport or in maybe on television or even in your local community that you could say, they look like me, they're the same as me? Or were you, as far as you knew, the only person who had a condition like yours?
Exactly. So that was the problem. You know, there were very little representation in Singapore when it came to people with disabilities. I would very rarely see somebody else with a physical disability on the street. And the only time when I saw somebody on a wheelchair, it was not a empowering situation as well. It didn't show me what I could do, what I could be. It really made me feel very alone in this world. I think now the awareness has really grown, but it definitely needs to be more. The only time I saw somebody else on a wheelchair in the papers was probably fellow Paralympian Teresa Goh. She's 5 years my senior. So at that point in time when I saw that there was a possibility that there was such a competition, that people with disabilities could do sports, I was extremely excited about it. Then I realized, yes, maybe one day I would be there. I watched Teresa go there. So maybe one day I will train as hard, go as far in life. Who knows?
I actually have been to Singapore. I'm curious, you know, having traveled and spent a bit of time in Asia, and like you said, we don't see a lot of people with disability in Asia out in the public. It's not super common. So given that, and even for me to witness, I would say still the stigma that's attached with disability in the region, what are your thoughts or views about that? And do you believe it's changed? Do you feel like perhaps specifically in Singapore that there's been an inclusion or an acceptance to disability?
Mm. I feel specifically in Singapore, it's really gotten a little bit better since 2008. In the past, the mindset used to be that as long as you had a disability, you didn't really do much with your life. But now it's no longer called like suffering with a disability. It's just having a disability and kind of living your life to the fullest. I think not everyone in the community is at this point yet, but a lot of people have realized that it's possible. In the past, when I was taking taxis, Ubers, it just felt a lot harder because there would be this perception that drivers wouldn't really be happy to pick up a passenger with a disability. But now it's different. Now the people I meet are always nice most of the time. And there are like awareness movements like the Purple Parade in Singapore, where everybody comes together to support inclusion and celebrate abilities. Small things like that where we can try to raise awareness. The government is providing more support for people with disabilities. Corporates are bigger on this whole diversity and inclusion movement. And I think it's really helped us advance forward as a society.
Let's take a look at another picture.
This is family.
Aww.
There's a beautiful cake on a coffee table in the foreground. And then I think I've got you in the middle and you've got family all around you. And it looks like parents are at the back of the shot.
Mm-hmm.
It just looks like a very loving and a very supportive moment. Who's in this picture? Who are these people who are also a part of this journey you've been on?
Yep, at the back, those two are my parents. The right of me, my brother, and the left of me, my sister-in-law. The two kids are my nephews. I do have another brother who lives in another country, but we are a really tight-knit family, and I'm appreciative of the support they've shown me throughout the years. You know, so Singapore is a society where academics and education really comes first. A lot of people aren't allowed to explore their interests outside of education at a younger age, but my parents have really trusted me to make the right decisions with my life, and that I know what I want enough And they've never really put on additional stress for me to be an extremely good student or to do well, get really good grades. I mean, I didn't turn out that bad.
Yeah, pretty good, pretty good. National hero, you know, that's pretty good.
Yeah, but so there was something that I think was crucial in my journey, just really having their support and being allowed to do what I wanted to do. My dad would be the one sending me to training most of the time, but I think at a point in time, my brother started driving. They would also start ferrying me to training during the weekends, picking me up. Mom would provide a lot of nutritious food just for me to recover and to be the best athlete that I can. So really, they were my first support team, my biggest cheerleaders, even until today.
When you won the gold medal at 16, I think you very much became a key that helped to unlock your country's understanding of what the Paralympics is and what disability is and also what it isn't. Were your parents helpful also in, I guess, protecting you at that point? Because was it the case that suddenly everybody wanted to talk to you? Everybody wanted to interview you and find out about you, but they had to look after their little girl as well, didn't they? You were only 16.
In a way, but also I think they really gave me a lot of free rein as even at that age, you know, at 16, they trusted the National Para Association to have my best interests at heart. They trusted the people around me to protect me. And I think the people around me did a good job. So when I was a mere 16-year-old, I was so shy. I didn't want to take any interviews. It would be Teresa handing me the phone and then encouraging me to speak to somebody. And at a point in time, I was so shy that, like, if somebody asked me how was my swim, the only thing I could say was, oh, it was good.
You're doing great.
You know, I was a terrible interviewee. Making up for it now.
Doing fantastically, yes.
Yes, thank you. But I really had to grow along with, nobody really was before me telling me what I needed to do except Teresa. So really had to grow along the way. Wouldn't say I was pushed into the deep end, but even if I was, I could swim. But yeah, so it wasn't an easy journey growing up, but I love, there's no part in the journey that I would change at this point in time.
As a fellow Paralympian and para-athlete, I want to bring up a topic that, and I don't know if this is still the case in Singapore, so educate us if it isn't, but in a majority of countries around the globe, when you win a medal at the Paralympic Games, the compensation payout for that medal is, in most places, not equal to what the Olympic payout is for that medal, that same medal. So is that still the case in Singapore? I know you've been very vocal about this topic, and can you just shed light on it?
So back in 2008, we've never had an Olympic gold medalist before. So as a nation, they really wanted to encourage it. So if you won an Olympic gold medal, the award for that would be $1 million. So in 2008, for the Paralympics, it was 10% of that. It was $100,000. And I think this disparity really shocked a lot of people, a lot of Singaporeans, just because like 10% compared to 100% was a lot of different. They were so proud of whoever won something at the Paralympics or the Olympics that they felt that the same kind of treatment should be awarded, the same kind of glory should be awarded, that at the end of the day, all these athletes are fighting for their country, so why is it not the same? Of course, there was a lot of people saying that, oh, it's different because there's less competition in the Paralympics, it's different because it's not as tough, but at the same time, also a lot of people showing support.
That's really interesting. So partly, do you think there was like extra energy because this was such a patriotic thing, this first Olympic arena win? They were like, we want this to be as meaningful as possible.
Yeah, and this debate pretty much comes out every 4 years. So when it first came out, it shifted from 10% to 20%. I think it was after Tokyo that it shifted to 40%. So we found more sponsors for it and people willing to show their support for it. So it took many, many years. Now for Paris, it will be 50%. So really, it's been a long journey. It's baby steps where everybody really fights for this kind of awareness and equality. But end of the day, I'm just thankful that the needle is moving, that people are still supportive of us. People are really very proud of their athletes. And I think this kind of sporting culture is important in which whatever country, for you to be proud of all your athletes, regardless of ability.
Well, this is just my opinion, but I don't think 50% is enough. And, you know, in the U.S., we just recently made the medal payouts equal at the most recent Paralympic Games. Now, granted, our payout is significantly less than $1 million. But what I will say is I've always said it's really not about what the total is. It's more what it symbolizes. So if you're only getting 50% of what the Olympic winner is getting, to me, that's a reflection of who you value in your country and what you value. At least if we receive equal pay here, that tells me that you value people with disabilities, their achievements, their talents, their hard work in the same way that you value the achievements and hard work of non-disabled athletes.
My sentiments exactly. And I really do hope that in time to come, it would get more and more equal. People would see that the effort put into training is as much, would see that the human spirit behind the medal, behind the athlete, behind the games is as much. And I think at the end of the day, that's what sport is about, really. It's about the sacrifices you've made along the way, the mindset that you have to get you on the podium. And it's always such a beautiful story.
Is that tied into how much money is made from the games? Because I feel like a lot of times in situations like this, the argument would be like, there aren't as many people watching, it doesn't generate as much money. But I also feel like when there's more money involved, suddenly people are paying a lot more attention and it becomes more interesting. Is that an aspect of this at all? Or because I just don't understand the economics of it.
It's a chicken and egg thing as well, right? Like if you don't value the games enough, of course, you're not going to watch more of it. But if you see the same kind of value in it, the same kind of equality across abilities, then of course, more people would also watch both the Olympics and the Paralympics. You know, it's also really competitive. It's also really exciting. You just sometimes have to give it a shot. It's not conventional. It's not the same thing, but it is still a competition and extremely exciting.
I very much agree with the chicken and egg thing because I think it works in both directions. That's what I'm saying. Like if they raised the price, people would be like, oh, this is $1 million sport? Well, I definitely want to watch it then.
Yeah.
Sorry to make you discuss the intricacies of the economics.
You're listening to On the Podium with me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. With us is Yip Pin Xiu, Singapore's multiple Paralympic gold medalist.
Let's take a look at another photo.
All looking professional.
Yes, this is you as a nominated member of Singapore's parliament, something you did between 2018 and 2020. And you have your tablet out in front of you and you have your water bottle and you looking, the glasses are on. It looks like you're about to make a very important point. First of all, though, tell us how becoming a member of parliament happened and being a nominated member. Is that different to being voted in? How did you find yourself? And this is what, in between a couple of Paralympic Games, isn't it? Between Rio and Tokyo. So you're still a full-time athlete. You've still got more gold medals that you're going to go on and win. How did this happen? This phase of your life happens?
So Singapore's political system, there are members of parliament in which you are elected in by your community, and then there are nominated members of parliament in which you are selected to go in and you represent a certain sector. So it could be the sports, it could be sustainability, economics, education, mental health, anything, you know. So this year they needed a sports NMP. My name was put up by someone, I have no idea who, but this was a really interesting experience for me because I've always been really interested in policy making, in strategic thinking and things like that. But it was so different, you know. Going in there, I took a while to learn about it. It was a steep learning curve. And eventually when I was comfortable enough, I could start to talk about sports, para sports. But really, it went beyond that. Eventually, I also represented the inclusion space. I also represented women, youth. You know, I would speak to people on the ground and then gather all the feedback, the messages, and then bring it back into Parliament and into a national level stage. So to me, it was an extremely amazing opportunity to share more about parasports. And it was a really good platform for everyone to understand more about it and eventually garner the same kind of support for the games.
What kind of changes, maybe I should say specifically, would you like to see in your country as it relates to people with disabilities?
I think our country, we really have identified three areas in which we need a bit more support in. The first one being education, second one employment, and then the third one being in a community, independent living and things like that. So really all stems from education. Our education system is amazing, but when it comes to the minorities and catering for people who need a bit more support, then that's where we need a bit more changes for everybody in the community to not fall through the gaps. Education is one thing, but I think community needs a bit more help when it comes to socializing, you know, esteem issues, confidence as a kid. And I think that can be built into education as well, more of an integration for people with disabilities. If you need a bit more help in school, then you have certain people on standby who are extremely nurturing that help you to fit into the community and not really segregate people with special needs and people in mainstream education. And I think there are people in the country looking at it and working on it.
Since your entry into the sport, do you see a lot more people getting into para-athletics in Singapore? Not so much.
This is difficult.
I imagine that people seeing you do what you've been able to do would probably inspire some people who may not have even known about this as an opportunity.
Yes, a handful, you know, and there are definitely more opportunities for people in the community to do sports. And I think that that's amazing. One day when I retire from swimming, I do also want to take these opportunities to try different sports. And I'm looking forward to that.
You have any on the list already or of sports you want to try?
I do want to try skiing, even though that's not in Singapore.
It's a total different time of year sport.
Yes. Might have to go somewhere else.
Correct. I'll come look for you.
We've talked a lot about, I guess, how Singapore has evolved in its attitudes. What about the Paralympics itself? Your first Games was 2008. What's the health of the Paralympic movement like as far as you're concerned? Is it where it needs to be? And if it needs to be doing more or different things, what are the things you would like to see happen?
This is such a high-level question. The movement really has grown, especially, I think, after London 2012. London did such an amazing job promoting the Games, spreading the movement that it's such a common, normal thing in the UK now that people know about the Paralympics. So the Games really has grown a lot in the past few years. Of course, we want to continue growing. We want more people to watch the Paralympics to support para sports in general. And what I can only say about is swimming. We've really had a lot more athletes, a lot of younger athletes come up in the recent years. And the field is getting a lot more competitive as well. There really is movement, there is growth, and I think in the next couple of years, it's crucial to maintain this energy and growth throughout it and see where it will eventually get us.
Well, in my opinion and just my thoughts, I think that Singapore, the Paralympic movement, is so lucky to have you as a face, a representative of what it's all about. And you're doing just an absolutely tremendous job speaking out about it, and I took a peep on your social media, and you're very visible and talking about a lot of the issues. And from a fellow Paralympian, I'm very proud of everything that you're doing in that part of the world to push our movement forward.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Well, speaking of the visibility of para athletes, I think we have another photo.
And this looks like a photo shoot. Looks like it could be a magazine shoot. This is you. You're sitting on a white chair and you're wearing a whenever it comes to fashion, I'm dreadful. You're wearing a long flowing dress, which looks beautiful. I'm dealing in generalities now. I'm out of my comfort zone. But we were talking about visibility and about photo shoots and magazines and stuff. Is this one such instance? What's this for?
So we have a local magazine called Her World. It's by our local newspaper companies, and in March they had a issue where the theme was strength, and it was amazing because I think I've always on a secret bucket list that I have, I've always wanted to be on the cover of a magazine.
What girl doesn't?
Yes, so when I heard about it, I was so excited to be able to be the face of disability sports in Singapore, have this kind of representation. It's really a special moment that we've come so far, and that the first person people think of when they think of strength could be a Paralympian, could be a para-athlete. And it's been such a journey that I am essentially just 16-year-old me would be surprised that we've come this far. Just really, really proud of everything that we've managed to achieve as a country.
How much community is there within the world of para-athletics, Paralympians? And it sounds, you know, I talk to you guys and work with Scout, and it feels like everybody's all over the world, so spread out. Does it feel like there's a real community there too?
I don't know, it's difficult to tell. Like, when I hear that somebody else is a Paralympian, of course I instantly feel connected with them. You know, they kind of know the struggles and training and everything it takes to get 1 second faster, to get a few milliseconds faster. And there's really an instant connection. So for me, I'm definitely friends with a lot of the swimmers. Maybe not so much outside of the sport, but I follow like Scott on Instagram, and there is a community, a secret hidden community. It's just that not everyone knows each other. But I think as long as you say that you've been to the Paralympics, you are a Paralympian, regardless of whether you're an athlete, a coach, a support staff, a volunteer, there is a special kind of connection.
Obviously for you, Paris is next, which would be your fifth Paralympic Games, and you've so far won 5 Paralympic golds. How much longer do you hope to continue swimming at the elite level? And when you are no longer swimming competitively, what do you want to do next?
The answer for this changes sometimes, you know. Like when I was 16, I didn't know that I wanted to continue. After London, I knew for sure that I was not done. And then after Rio, I was like, yeah, maybe, why not another one? You know, so at the earliest of this point in time, I can say that it would either be 1 more year, which seems too short, or 5 more years, which seems really long. So I'm at this point where I'm still deciding what I want to do. I love this life. You know, even though I wake up so early in the morning, even though training is so tiring that sometimes I just ask myself, why am I putting myself through this? Well, very often I ask myself that, but at the end of the day, I love what I do. Which other career allows you not only allows you, but it's mandatory to take an afternoon nap to recover. You know, where can I find this?
Not many jobs where you're going to be able to do that.
Exactly. And I love it. So I love pushing myself to the limits, training, and things like that. You know, there are some athletes that only love competition, and there's some athletes that only love training. I'm thankful that I'm one of those that love both. You know, I love the entire journey about it. And I really have no idea when I will stop, but I have made steps to make sure that the one day that I decided that I want to retire from sports, that I do have an identity outside of being an athlete. And this is often not discussed. Athletes moving on from their sport after that, you know, what happens. So I do want to make sure that I have a plan for that already. And it's exciting because I feel that there are opportunities.
It sounds like you're laying out a very smart path in front of you. And we are excited to see what comes along for you. And we'll be rooting for you the whole way. Thank you so much for giving us so much time.
Thank you so much.
Next year in Paris, let's make it a point to link up and meet in person. Maybe we can meet in the village. I would love that.
Yes, I'll be in the dining hall.
Okay, I'll find you there.
Once again, I feel very unaccomplished in my life. I've never been in a single parliament. I'm way behind. She's amazing.
Pinchu is a genuine pioneer. She was the first person to win that Paralympic gold medal, or to win a gold medal for Singapore in the Olympic arena as well. And to take it in your stride, but very gently, firmly, to kind of demonstrate and show and pull people along on a journey. And how long has it been? It's probably been half a lifetime ago for her. And ever since she won that gold medal, she's been changing things, showing, explaining, bringing more people with her, and just captivating to hear. And it's like juggling, isn't it? Like you say, Parliament, still a competing athlete, still a gold medal capable athlete, and juggling all these different things.
Guys, I just love her. I actually did not know much about her before, you know, us having her on. She's taken the opportunities that she's been given and really using it for good. And but the thing I was really most struck about in her talking about some of the issues and the things that she's hoping to push in her country is that the issues that people with disability face is everywhere. And perhaps that's why the Paralympic community is very unique and special, because these are issues that, you know, whether you're in a first world country or in a third world country, whether you have a lot of opportunity or little opportunity, the fight to have visibility, to have equal pay, to get an education, employment, all the issues she talked about, that's everywhere. And, you know, I think she's doing obviously a great job of speaking out about those things.
Yeah, it really does feel like it's visibility, like on all levels. Do you see people like this on the street in your community? Is your community a place where people can navigate well so that, you know, everyone is a part of the community? And there are all these things that if you don't have to think about them, very often people just don't. So do you scout as somebody who's at kind of the top of that visibility? Does it feel like a lot of pressure sometimes that like you have to not just live your life, but represent?
The pressure that I feel is more the opportunities I get. I realize how unique and how rare they are. And I feel like I've got to make the most of it, or I've got to represent our people, right, in the right way, so that more of us will get those opportunities. Boy, if I go and blow it, they might say, hey, we're not going to have another Paralympian, or we're not going to have another Asian woman, or whatever it might be. And so, and certainly I would say that's more the pressure that I feel in that sense of just being like, you know, I want to be a trailblazer, and I want the experience of the people I'm with or work with, or the people that see me, where it's so positive that they say, we want more of them.
I guess also right at the end when we said, what's next? And it was like, I'm not sure what's next, but I can tell you that I've set up like a training center for young people and I'm doing this and I'm doing that. So, I mean, some of the people we've spoken to, not the whole reason they're on our program, but one of the reasons they join us on the podcast is because
they fell apart.
Yeah, exactly. It all fell to pieces.
Yeah, well, I almost said something, but I was like, she clearly already knows. She doesn't need me to say, good, good, that's right. But also, it also makes me think, like, when I asked about her, if there were more, she was seeing more Paralympians, like if she was inspiring people. I imagine, my theory is that there are a lot more, and she is, but it's still not as many as she would like there to be.
A lot later, she might find out way later on in her life when there's an athlete that comes through and is, I'm sure, going to give an interview one day saying that she inspired them, right? Or she was the first person they saw.
So we should put her address out on the podcast so they can write letters to her?
Well, that's it from me, Eliza Skinner, Scout Bassett, and Ed Harry. And join us next time for more of this.
I would just start to panic just at the thought of going anywhere. Then I would panic about panicking. And it kind of just like spiraled and grew into this big thing. It was just like I was paralyzed. Like I couldn't do it. And I had no idea why.
Swiss biker and bronze medalist Nikita DeCroze on how BMX saved her life. Next time on The Podium.
Wait, so you said you genetically engineered yourself.
I put a foreign piece of DNA inside my cells.
Wow!
Crowd Science, the podcast for those with a thirst for knowledge and an appetite for explanation.
My question is, how do we navigate in space?
Each week, we take your science questions and go in search of the answers.
Just hold on to your hat.
That is incredibly clever.
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service. Just search for Crowd Science wherever you found this podcast.